Chapter 14. Railways, tunnels, newspapers, and new editions of books, they were too early in the field. The want shall never be felt because, free of the trammels of the tide, easy of access, magnificent and desolate, they are already there, prepared to take and keep the biggest ships that float upon the sea. They are worthy of the oldest river port in the world. And, truth to say, for all the criticisms flung upon the heads of the dock companies, the other docks of the Thames are no disgrace to the town with a population greater than that of some commonwealths. The growth of London as a well-equipped port has been slow, while not unworthy of a great capital, of a great center of distribution. It must not be forgotten that London has not the backing of great industrial districts, or great fields of natural exploitation. In this it differs from Liverpool, from Cardiff, from Newcastle, from Glasgow, and there the Thames differs from the Mersey, from the Tyne, from the Clyde. It is an historical river. It is a romantic stream flowing through the center of great affairs, and for all the criticism of the river's administration, my contention is that its development has been worthy of its dignity. For a long time the stream itself could accommodate quite easily the oversea and coasting traffic. That was in the days when, in the part called the Pool, just below London Bridge, the vessels moored stem and stern in the very strength of the tide formed one solid mass like an island covered with a forest of gaunt leafless trees. And when the trade had grown too big for the river, there came the St. Catherine's docks and the London docks, magnificent undertakings answering to the need of their time. The same may be said of the other artificial lakes full of ships that go in and out upon this high road to all parts of the world. The labor of the imperial waterway goes on from generation to generation, goes on day and night. Nothing ever arrests its sleepless industry but the coming of a heavy fog, which clothes the teeming stream in a mantle of impenetrable stillness. After the gradual cessation of all sound and movement on the faithful river, only the ringing of ships' bells is heard, mysterious and muffled in the white vapor from London Bridge right down to the Nore, for miles and miles in a decrescendo tinkling, to where the estuary broadens out into the North Sea, and the anchored ships lie scattered thinly in the shrouded channels between the sandbanks of the Thames's mouth. Through the long and glorious tale of years of the river's strenuous service to its people, these are its only breathing times. XXXIII. A ship in dock, surrounded by quays and the walls of warehouses, has the appearance of a prisoner meditating upon freedom in the sadness of a free spirit put under restraint. Chain cables and stout ropes keep her bound, two stone posts at the edge of a paved shore, and a berthing master, with brass buttons on his coat, walks about like a weather-beaten and ruddy galler, casting jealous, watchful glances upon the moorings that fetter a ship lying passive, unstill and safe, as if lost in deep regrets of her days of liberty and danger on the sea. The swarm of renegades, dockmasters, berthing masters, gatemen, and such like appear to nurse an immense distrust of the captive ship's resignation. There never seem chains and ropes enough to satisfy their minds concerned with the safe binding of free ships to the strong, muddy, enslaved earth. "Who had better put another bite of a hawser astern, Mr. Mate," is the usual phrase in their mouth. I brand them for renegades, because most of them have been sailors in their time. As if the infirmities of old age, the gray hair, the wrinkles at the corners of the eyes, and the knotted veins of the hands, were the symptoms of moral poison, they prowl about the quays with an underhand air of gloating over the broken spirit of noble captives. They want more fenders, more breasting ropes. They want more springs, more shackles, more fetters. They want to make ships with volatile souls as motionless as square blocks of stone. They stand on the mud of pavements, these degraded sea dogs, with long lines of railway trucks clanking their couplings behind their backs, and run malevolent glances over your ship from headgear to taffrail, only wishing to tyrannize over the poor creature under the hypocritical cloak of benevolence and care. Here and there cargo cranes looking like instruments of torture for ships swing cruel hooks at the end of long chains. Gangs of dock laborers swarm with muddy feet over the gangways. It is a moving sight, this, of so many men of the earth, earthy, who never cared anything for a ship, trampling unconcerned, brutal and hobnailed upon her helpless body. Fortunately, nothing can deface the beauty of a ship. That sense of a dungeon, that sense of a horrible and degrading misfortune overtaking a creature fair to see, and safe to trust, attaches only to ships moored in the docks of great European ports. You feel that they are dishonestly locked up, to be hunted about from wharf to wharf on a dark, greasy, square pool of black water as a brutal reward at the end of a faithful voyage. A ship anchored in an open roadstead, with cargo lighters alongside and her own tackle swinging the burden over the rail, is accomplishing in freedom a function of her life. There is no restraint, there is space. Clear water around her, and a clear sky above her mastheads, with a landscape of green hills, and charming bays opening around her anchorage. She is not abandoned by her own men to the tender mercies of shore people. She still shelters, and is looked after by, her own little devoted band, and you feel that presently she will glide between the headlands and disappear. It is only at home, in dock, that she lies abandoned, shut off from freedom by all the artifices of men, that think of quick dispatch and profitable freights. It is only then that the odious, rectangular shadows of walls and roofs fall upon her decks, with showers of soot. To a man who has never seen the extraordinary nobility, strength, and grace that the devoted generations of shipbuilders have evolved from some pure nooks of their simple souls, the sight that could be seen 25 years ago of a large fleet of clippers moored along the north side of the New South Dock was an inspiring spectacle. Then there was a quarter of a mile of them, from the iron dockyard gates guarded by policemen, in a long, forest-like perspective of masts, moored two and two to many stout wooden jetties. Their spars dwarfed with their loftiness the corrugated iron sheds, their jibbooms extended far over the shore, their white and gold figureheads, almost dazzling in their purity, overhung the straight, long quay above the mud and dirt of the wharfside, with the busy figures of groups, and single men moving to and fro, restless and grimy under their soaring immobility. At tide time you would see one of the loaded ships with battened down hatches drop out of the ranks and float in the clear space of the dock, held by lines dark and slender, like the first threads of a spider's web, extending from her bows and her quarters to the mooring posts on shore. There, graceful and still, like a bird ready to spread its wings, she waited till, at the opening of the gates, a tug or two would hurry in noisily, hovering round her with an air of fuss and solicitude, and take her out into the river, tending, shepherding her through open bridges, through dam-like gates between the flat pier heads, with a bit of green lawn surrounded by gravel, and a white signal mast with yard and gaff, flying a couple of dingy blue, red, or white flags. This New South Dock, it was its official name, round which my earlier professional memories are centered, belongs to the group of West India docks, together with two smaller, and much older basins called Import and Export respectively, both with the greatness of their trade departed from them already. Picturesque and clean as docks go, these twin basins spread side by side the dark luster of their glassy water, sparely peopled by a few ships laid up on buoys, or tucked far away from each other at the end of sheds in the corners of empty quays, where they seem to slumber quietly remote, untouched by the bustle of men's affairs in retreat, rather than in captivity. They were quaint and sympathetic, those two homely basins, unfurnished and silent, with no aggressive display of cranes, no apparatus of hurry and work on their narrow shores. No railway lines cumbered them. The knots of laborers trooping in clumsily round the corners of cargo sheds, to eat their food in peace out of red cotton handkerchiefs had the air of picnicking by the side of a lonely mountain pool. They were restful and I should say very unprofitable. Those basins, where the chief officer of one of the ships involved in the harassing, strenuous, noisy activity of the New South Dock only a few yards away could escape in the dinner hour to stroll, unhampered by men and affairs, meditating, if he chose, on the vanity of all things human. At one time they must have been full of good old slow West Indiamen of the square stern type that took their captivity, one imagines, as stolidly as they had faced the buffeting of the waves with their blunt, honest bows, and disgorged sugar, rum, molasses, coffee, or logwood sedately with their own winch and tackle. But when I knew them, of exports there was never a sign that one could detect. And all the imports I have ever seen were some rare cargoes of tropical timber, enormous bulks roughed out of iron trunks grown in the woods about the Gulf of Mexico. They lay piled up in stacks of mighty boles, and it was hard to believe that all this mass of dead, unstripped trees had come out of the flanks of a slender, innocent-looking little bark with, as likely as not, a homely woman's name Ellen Isserani, that upon her fine boughs. But this is generally the case with a discharged cargo. Once spread at large over the quay, it looks the most impossible bulk to have all come there out of that ship alongside. They were quiet, serene nooks in the busy world of docks, these basins where it has never been my good luck to get a berth after some more or less arduous passage. But one could see at a glance that men and ships were never hustled there. They were so quiet that, remembering them well, one comes to doubt that they ever existed, places of repose for tired ships to dream in, places of meditation rather than work, where wicked ships, the cranky, the lazy, the wet, the bad sea boats, the wild steers, the capricious, the pig-headed, the generally ungovernable, would have full leisure to take count and repent of their sins, sorrowful and naked, with their rent garments of sailcloth stripped off them, and with the dust and ashes of the London atmosphere upon their mastheads. For that the worst of ships would repent, if she were ever given time, I make no doubt. I have known too many of them. No ship is wholly bad. And now that their bodies, that had braved so many tempests, have been blown off the face of the sea by a puff of steam, the evil and the good together into the limbo of things that have served their time, there can be no harm in affirming that in these vanished generations of willing servants there never has been one utterly unredeemable soul. In the New South Dock there was certainly no time for remorse, introspection, repentance, or any phenomena of inner life either for the captive ships or for their officers. From 6 in the morning till 6 at night the hard labor of the prison house, which rewards the valiance of ships, that when the harbor went on steadily, great slings of general cargo swinging over the rail, to drop plumb into the hatchways at the sign of the gangway tender's hand. The New South Dock was especially a loading dock for the colonies in those great and last days of smart wool clippers, good to look at and well exciting to handle. Some of them were more fair to see than the others. Many were, to put it mildly, somewhat overmasted. All were expected to make good passages. And of all that line of ships, whose rigging made a thick, enormous network against the sky, whose brasses flashed almost as far as the eye of the policeman at the gates could reach, there was hardly one that knew of any other port amongst all the ports on the wide earth, but London and Sydney, or London and Melbourne, or London and Adelaide, perhaps with Hobart Town added for those of smaller tonnage. One could almost have believed, as her grey-whiskered second mate used to say of the old Duke of S, that they knew the road to the Antipodes better than their own skippers, who, year in, year out, took them from London, the place of captivity, to some Australian port where, 25 years ago, though moored well, and tight enough to the wooden wharves, they felt themselves no captives, but honored guests. XXXIV. These towns of the Antipodes, not so great then as they are now, took an interest in the shipping, the running links with Ohm, whose numbers confirmed the sense of their growing importance. They made it part and parcel of their daily interests. This was especially the case in Sydney, where, from the heart of the fair city, down the vista of important streets, could be seen the wool clippers lying at the circular cano-walled prison house of a dock that, but the integral part of one of the finest, most beautiful, vast, and safe bays the sun ever shone upon. Now great steam liners lie at these berths, always reserved for the sea aristocracy, grand and imposing enough ships, but here today and gone next week, whereas the general cargo, emigrant, and passenger clippers of my time, rigged with heavy spars, and built on fine lines, used to remain for months together waiting for their load of wool. Their names attained the dignity of household words. On Sundays and holidays the citizens trooped down, on visiting bent, and the lonely officer on duty, solaced himself by playing the cicerone especially to the citizenesses with engaging manners, and a well-developed sense of the fun, that may be got out of the inspection of a ship's cabins and staterooms. The tinkle of more or less untuned cottage pianos floated out of open stern ports till the gas lamps began to twinkle in the streets, and the ship's night watchman, coming sleepily on duty after his unsatisfactory day slumbers, hauled down the flags, and fastened a lighted lantern at the break of the gangway. The night closed rapidly upon the silent ships with their crews on shore. Up a short, steep ascent by the King's Head pub, patronized by the cooks and stewards of the fleet, the voice of a man crying "Ot Savilois!" at the end of George Street, where the cheap eating houses, sixpence a meal, were kept by Chinamen, "Sun come ons" was not bad, is heard at regular intervals. I have listened for hours to this most pertinacious peddler. I wonder whether he is dead, or has made a fortune, while sitting on the rail of the old Duke of S. She's dead. Poor thing, a violent death on the coast of New Zealand, fascinated by the monotony, the regularity, the abruptness of the recurring cry, and so exasperated at the absurd spell, that I wished the fellow would choke himself to death with a mouthful of his own infamous wares. A stupid job, and fit only for an old man, my comrades used to tell me, to be the night watchman of a captive, though honored, ship. And generally the oldest of the able seamen in a ship's crew does get it. But sometimes neither the oldest nor any other fairly steady seaman is forthcoming. Ship's crews had the trick of melting away swiftly in those days. So, probably on account of my youth, innocence, and pensive habits which made me sometimes dilatory in my work about the rigging, I was suddenly nominated, in our chief mate Mr. B.S. most sardonic tones, to that enviable situation. I do not regret the experience. The night humors of the town descended from the street to the waterside in the still watches of the night. Larrikins rushing down in bands to settle some quarrel by a stand-up fight, away from the police, in an indistinct ring half hidden by piles of cargo, with the sounds of blows, a groan now and then, the stamping of feet, and the cry of time, rising suddenly above the sinister and excited murmurs. Night prowlers, pursued or pursuing, with a stifled shriek followed by a profound silence, or slinking stealthily alongside like ghosts, and addressing me from the quay below in mysterious tones with incomprehensible propositions. The cabman who twice a week, on the night when the A.S.S.N. Company's passenger boat was due to arrive, used to range a battalion of blazing lamps opposite the ship, were very amusing in their way. They got down from their perches, and told each other impolite stories in racy language, every word of which reached me distinctly over the bulwarks as I sat smoking on the main hatch. On one occasion I had an hour or so of a most intellectual conversation with a person whom I could not see distinctly, a gentleman from England. He said, with a cultivated voice, "I on deck, and he on the quay sitting on the case of a piano, landed out of our hold that very afternoon, and smoking a cigar which smelt very good. We touched, in our discourse, upon science, politics, natural history, and operatic singers. Then, after remarking abruptly, 'You seem to be rather Gutenberg edition.'" End of chapter.